two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why, hello there. It's your old pal, Sarah Silverman, and I'm back with a brand new season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast. On my podcast, I am talking about everything. Politics? Yeah, we get into it. Favorite sandwich shop in L.A.? I know a few spots, and I'm going to tell you about them. I'm also going to be talking to you. I will be reacting and responding to listener voicemails in real time. Let me tell you, things can get weird, and I love every second of it. Weird is my comfort zone. The newest season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
The bottom line is, if we don't act now, our hospital system will be overwhelmed. If we don't act now, we'll continue to see a death rate climb, more lives lost. And that's why today we are pursuant to the blueprint we put out some 14 or so weeks ago, pulling that emergency brake. We've done it sequentially over the course of the last number of weeks, but we're doing it in a much more broad and much more comprehensive way today. We are announcing and introducing a regional stay-at-home order in the state of California.
Welcome to In the Bubble. This is Andy Slavitt. That was Governor Gavin Newsom, and it really could have been almost any governor in the United States talking about the situation in their states and the need for pullback, more regulation, stay-at-home orders. Restaurants are closed across California. And, you know, one of the things I think, having been on the phone over a course of time with a number of the governors, that's really interesting is, you know, April, the governors were acting early because they knew that this was an exponentially growing virus. I feel like now all the governors are doing things just a little too late, taking smaller steps. First, they closed the bars by 10, then they closed the bars at 8, then they closed the bars at 6. A week later, they've closed the bars. Look, these are not easy decisions for anyone, for governors or anyone else. And it's a reflection on the fact that Congress has not supported bar owners and people who work in bars. It makes it incredibly difficult on governors. But still, hospitals are filling. We have an incredible amount of people dying. And it's, while these are very difficult choices, I don't envy anyone having to make them. There's no question you choose human life because there's no bouncing back. And I think we're seeing that now as things continue to get worse. I hope you're being safe in every way. And I hope that you don't need a hospital for a while because it's getting to be very challenging. We will start to peak. Things will start to drop. There's no question. You know, as people are locked down in most communities, that will happen. But it's going to take a while for this to burn through and burn off. And, you know, there's pretty good evidence now that as soon as the governors let up, people are going to be back at it again. And I think you should all just be very careful. We're trying to be careful here in our bubble. And I want to say a quick thanks to a few people. In the Bubble got recognized as one of the top podcasts or one of the best podcasts or one of the favorite podcasts of 2020. That was very nice to see. I guess I want to just say thank you to you for listening. Obviously, if people didn't listen, Apple wouldn't feel that way. Although, you know, I know that they appreciate other elements. This, I want to say thank you to Christy and Alex, who, as you know, are the production team on this, and they own every bit of this show as much as I do. And in fact, you know, they do most of the work, and I kind of don't know what I'm doing. I want to thank Ivan Kuryev. He's the editor of the show. Like, he is making sure it sounds good. And the rest of the Lemonada team for putting this on. But it's great. Of the, I think, you know, there are 12 podcasts that got recognized. I think that was, there's 13 podcasts in the world, so I think we got 12 out of 13, and we're pretty proud of that. No, there's more than 13 podcasts, as you know, so we're happy about that. Lori Garrett is on the show today. Lori Garrett is an award-winning science journalist. She's an author. She and I have just gotten to know one another over the last few months, I'd say. She is a very strong, thoughtful person with lots of opinions. She won the Pulitzer Prize in 1996 for explanatory journalism for a series that chronicled the Ebola virus outbreak in Zaire. She has been giving TED Talks and writing and talking about pandemics and their consequences for a long time. And the topic that Lori and I really try to hone in on is how we manage this pandemic through this very divided country, where we have, it seems to be, two different tribes. And I know you know what I'm talking about, two different giant bubbles that are really causing people to respond very, very differently. And the question on my mind and on a lot of people's mind is, how does Joe Biden tackle these two different parts of the country, these two different ways of thinking? And Lori is a perfect person to talk about this with, as I think you'll see. So let's dial up Lori and have that conversation.
I was just sending you a thing saying I was giving up.
I know you have no patience whatsoever. None.
That's right. None. I was on and it just kept saying the host is in another meeting. I'm like, oh, I'm not good enough for you? Okay, Andy, you got somebody's better priority than me.
Yeah, get out. You know, I've talked about you coming on the show for a little while. So you get massively high expectations to beat, but I'm not worried about that. The thing that's like I found that you and I have gotten into a couple times close to talking about is this sort of impact of its divided country on the pandemic. In all of your work and in all of the things that you have thought about and all of your experience, both writing about and thinking about and speaking about pandemics, there's a lot that you were able to foresee. One of the things that I imagine is really interesting and different about this pandemic in the U.S. as opposed to the rest of the world is how it plays out with our divisions. How do you reflect on that?
You know, back in the spring, Frank Bruni of the New York Times did a profile of me. And I didn't actually realize he was doing a profile of me. I thought he was just interviewing me as background for a column he was working on at the New York Times. And when it came out, it had this enormous impact on my life because a whole lot of people suddenly heard about me. And one of the things I said in that interview was that I thought that there was going to be a lot of violence spawned by this epidemic and that the inequalities in our society that had been festering and worsening ever since the 2008 financial crisis were going to become explosive issues and bitter resentment and rage, and it would be American versus American. And when I saw my words in print in Frank's article, which I think, if I remember, recall right, was the first week of April, at the height of the epidemic in New York, I suddenly thought, oh my goodness, did I overstate this? You know, have I gone too far here? Well, flash forward, we go through Black Lives Matter. We go through riots in the streets all over America. We go through armed white vigilantes shooting at people and getting away with it, apparently. Apparently, that's justifiable homicide in America. We get to the point where, you know, a bartender or a bar owner on Staten Island used his vehicle as a weapon against the police, the NYPD, this week, because they were trying to enforce COVID limitations on who could come into his bar and force mask wearing. And now I actually think I understated way back when the likelihood of violence and separation in America. I think none of us really fully understood how likely it was that, you know, this damn mask would become a literal point of partisan separation. And that just this simple thing of a mask to wear when you go outside. Yeah, it muffles your voice a little bit. So who cares, you know, that should become a point of division that is party identity is absolutely astounding. That we would have failed messaging so thoroughly that we couldn't even bypass that. We're now at a point where even states that have Republican governors, Republican U.S. senators, and are getting advice from a Republican-run CDC are unable to enforce or even strongly suggest COVID protection measures, even once they see the light, because all their ICU beds are full, because their hospitals are now full, because they have refrigerator trucks lined up to receive bodies. They still seem unable to reverse the damage done among their base. So, you know, months and months and months of listening to Donald Trump say lie after lie after lie and exert maximum pressure on other Republicans to the point where they are in terror of getting a bad tweet from the president, so that even a governor who knows better and has reached a point where 30 or 40% of daily COVID tests are coming back positive among his citizenry and his hospitals are all full, even that governor is too scared, too frightened of the power of a Trump tweet to result in the base threatening his life. I think we've reached a point where everything has conflated, so that where you stand on whether or not we just had a righteous election in America or a fraud, where you stand on the anti-vax movement, where you stand on police brutality. All these issues have become conflated into a single mess, a conundrum. And I don't know how Biden is going to punch through all of this, because he has appointed a pretty remarkable, although I would say less than charismatic, coterie of health officials, or at least he's going to nominate them for approval by the Senate. And they're all people that will take reasoned decisions, let science guide the policy of COVID control, and will try to bolster and strengthen the ACA, Obamacare, try to bolster and strengthen access to vaccines, coverage through Medicare and Medicaid, all of these things. But, you know, they're up against a playing field that's already been so distorted that it's not clear we're all on playing the same game.
So what are we observing, Lori, that's going on in, call it Trump country versus, I guess we used to call it Clinton country now, or Obama country, but call it Biden country now officially. What does it look like in terms of compliance, in terms of belief in what the reality of this virus is, the description, and then do we know how that's showing up in terms of infections and illnesses and deaths?
Yeah, Andy, we have a pretty clear idea now that indeed we have a real division in belief. And there you start right there with that word, belief. You know, belief is a religious concept. Belief is an intellectual foray, but belief versus scientific hard facts, you know, the word belief, it should not be in the picture. And so you start off with, do you believe in the science? Do you believe in the reality? And do you believe in the evidence? And if you right at that point are already on the rejection side, then it's really hard to know how to reach you. And what I think 4 years of Donald Trump has done is undermine the concept that there are incontrovertible facts that should be a baseline that we all agree upon and act upon in concert. You know, is the sky blue? I don't know. According to Trump, maybe not. you know, are there things that human beings do that emit CO2 and are damaging our atmosphere? Well, it kind of depends on what day of the week it is. Donald Trump says yes some days and no others. And so I think the problem here is that very word, belief. It connotes the notion that actual facts are something we can take or leave, believe or not believe.
And is that showing up in the outcomes that we're seeing in rural America and Trump country, so to speak? Are we seeing that in the data?
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, first of all, I think anybody who's really seriously looked at the data is going to say the Sturgis motorcycle rally was a major turning point. 460,000 plus motorcyclists converging on a town that's normally got a population of about 2,000 and staying there for 10 days, frolicking, partying, nobody wearing masks, and then returning to their home states. Now, that we don't have hundreds of studies to look at, but the CDC did do one very careful and genetically based survey of motorcyclists that returned to Minnesota and showed very clearly that they spread the virus throughout their immediate community and their households and their close associates upon return to Minnesota. There are some studies indicating a similar effect in Wisconsin, Indiana, Iowa, North and South Dakota. We have such an explosive situation now, completely out of control in the Northern Prairie and Rust Belt states. I think, you know, that the fact that no one said in either South Dakota or the neighbor states, none of the governors, none of the leaders said, let's call this off. No Sturgis motorcycle rally this year. No one dared go up against them except the Oglala Sioux Nation, which said, you can't motorcycle through our community. And we're all paying a price for that. Now, there are any number of other smaller events that have occurred since, each of which could have been averted, could have been canceled, there could have been interventions, but for political reasons, such interventions never occurred.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me ask you the question that's a problem for both of us to try to wrestle with, which is the most material question right now. You've connected to it a little bit earlier, which is how to advise Joe Biden and how to reach the other half of the country. Actually, let me take a step back first. Someone built a model for me, which showed me that for every 10% of the public, additional 10% of the public that's non-compliant, either with masks or with the vaccine, it's 100,000 more deaths. So I use that as a rule of thumb in my head, that every 10% really counts. Every 1% really counts. Every person really counts. So that if you're Joe Biden, figuring out how to reach this other half of the country has got to be the most daunting challenge. He could nail everything else. Get the vaccines out. He can nail putting the right people in the right roles. He can nail having the people who are already inclined to wear masks. But if he doesn't do that, the virus doesn't go away. If people don't take the vaccine, if people don't, in some sense, comply and believe in their system that this is real. So how do you think he does it?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, right now he's focusing on the notion of patriotism. So the key message constantly is wear a mask. It's the patriotic thing to do. But I think in the end, there's a limit to what you can accomplish with the patriotism message, because we already have a division on what's a patriot. We have a blue state patriot and a red state patriot. So the question is, how do you get past this? And one thing I've been toying with and working with is trying to figure out if we just have sane, consistent messaging from all tiers of government, all tiers of the federal government at any rate, will that calm things down? Will that slowly begin to undermine the counter message? And I guess my answer is it depends on what Trump chooses to do. I mean, he could be a COVID-killing saboteur on the sidelines. If he chooses to use his tweet power, his whatever he does next in life, media presence, to simply attack everything that Biden does and all of the COVID efforts, it could keep the red-blue divide alive. It could make it impossible to roll out a vaccine effectively, to have sufficient coverage to take care of the population. It could be devastating. And so, I mean, I can only hope, along with everybody else, that Trump will take a different posture as an ex-president. But I don't see any evidence of that.
I think we know that some of the prior presidents, from Obama to Bush to Clinton, are planning on doing some work together around taking the vaccine. But what, there's one name that's absent from that, of course, and that's Trump. And I'm not sure whether he's invited into that or not. It'd probably be difficult for them to invite him. On the other hand, you can imagine the power of him actually deciding to be a statesperson.
Well, he's already declared that he's already immune.
Yeah.
You know, so he's already said, look, because I survived the virus, I have me like bulls, strong man, have great immune system. Mm-hmm. So he's unlikely to go on camera getting a vaccine. Now, Mike Pence might be our second best option. If Mike Pence, between now and Christmas, when presumably the FDA will give the Pfizer vaccine, the emergency approval, if he goes on camera and gets vaccinated, that may help. If Ivanka also goes on camera and gets vaccinated, that may help.
I was on a call with the esteemed lieutenant governor of Texas this week, who is about as far right as you can imagine. And he was talking about the vaccine, and I asked him if he would publicly acknowledge that he's taking the vaccine, and he said he would. And good for him. And he said Abbott, the governor of Texas, would as well. You know, I think the governor of Florida should do the same thing. Governor of South Dakota should do the same thing. And so this question around, is patriotism the right argument? I don't know. You know, I just don't know what it is that people are listening for. I know what people who are processing it intellectually are listening for. What's the data say? What did the Europeans do? Et cetera, et cetera.
Well, here's a question, Andy. Another way of looking at it, instead of trying so hard to puzzle it out in the American context, ask the question this way. Why hasn't it played out as dramatically as a schism over public health in Europe, in almost any European, as it has here? Yes, there have been isolated incidents of, you know, protesters opposing lockdowns or opposing various measures. But overall, Europeans have gone along with what their governments have advocated. And so if there's differences in Europe, it's also because the governments themselves are different and they've taken different policy choices. But look at the UK. They just went into a three-week all-out lockdown of the whole nation. And there were almost no incidents of resistance of any kind. People went along with the game. What's the key difference here? Why would you have compliance in Europe and not here? And I think of all the various hand-waving recipes on this, I think the answer that's the clearest is they have social safety nets. And so in the United States, when you say we're going on lockdown and your bar is closing and this is closing and that is closing, every one of those people goes on the unemployment line. Every one of those people is immediately economically affected. Every one of those children either does or doesn't go to school, either does or doesn't get lost. We've lost hundreds of thousands of children. They're not in school virtually or otherwise. We don't know where they are. We don't know. Are they learning to read? Have they forgotten everything? Have they forgotten their times tables? We don't know. And in this country, the attitude of our government seems to be, look, you know, it's tough that you lost your job and you might lose your apartment and you might not be able to make your mortgage payment. And, you're getting billed for your COVID treatment that was done to your grandmother and you can't pay the nursing home bills on your grandfather. All of this is really tough, but you know what? You're on your own because we're Americans. We don't
want freedom.
Socialism. We don't want, you know, if you want something different, you go talk to Bernie Sanders and AOC.
Right. Right. You know, it's interesting you say this because the social safety net brings one other thing with it. First of all, I agree with you 100%. But the other thing it brings with it is trust in government, that they have my back when I have a hard time. So when they ask something of me, when they ask me to wear a mask, when they ask me to do something for others, I'm more likely to trust that they're doing something that's good for all of us. Whereas in the US, we have a relationship where one party certainly has told us government is no good even when we're in it. You should trust it. And when the other team is in it, you absolutely shouldn't trust them. And so this kind of embedded distrust of government, which, by the way, goes all the way back to the revolution, right? I mean, it's somewhat part of our roots, to be a little bit fair about it, is, you know, and look, if you said, where's the best country to make $1 billion, it might be this country, it might be the U.S. But if you said, where's the best country to prevent hundreds of thousands of preventable deaths by people acting on each other's behalf, it certainly wouldn't be this country. And in that sense, I kind of wonder how much of this is just embedded endemic stuff and how much of it is the president, the soon-to-be former president.
Well, and you got to bring Congress into the picture as well, because certainly the big fight going on right now, as unemployment checks are about to run out, eviction protections are about to run out, millions of Americans are about to go to 1929, and be on the dole and stand in a food line. And Congress continues to dither and dither and dither and pair the agreed upon bipartisan possibilities down further and further by more than 50% already. And they still haven't reached an agreement. When you look at all this and ask, well, what's really going on? What's really behind all of this? You know, I think that that one party is saying we want to take advantage, if you will, of this pandemic crisis to build up elements of the safety net that we always wanted built up. So we're going to request 2 point something trillion. That's what came out of the House many months ago. 2 point something trillion that includes some not just temporary spending, but permanent changes in the law that will allocate going forward for certain kinds of social safety net coverage, such as programs for the preschools and protection and surveillance of nursing homes, that sort of thing. And the response on the Republican side is exactly the obvious opposite, because they are now, under Trump, the party anti-regulation, anti-government. They don't want to build up anything with any emergency spending bill that could result in permanent change in budgetary allotments or in the actions and interventions from government, right? They want a minimalist government. So, except, of course, when it comes to military and police. So they will say, no, we can't do any of that. So they're willing to spend in one-shot deal spending splurges for designated population groups, but they are not willing to make any structural changes. So I think where we are now is at logjams between the parties in Washington, and similarly at state levels, in state legislatures, over, is this a moment to consider the weaknesses of our systems and why we can't handle this epidemic? Or is this a moment to simply vote through a much pared down emergency spending thing to buy more time until we have full scale immunization of the population? And I fear that we're going to end up going to the latter. And we're going to go to it with a short-term bridging effect, so that in the sort of imagination of the political elite, there will be an effective vaccine, or vaccines, plural. It will be widespread in use nationwide, perhaps in a non-equitable fashion, but nevertheless out there for everybody to get immunized by the summer. And by this time next year, the majority of Americans will have either become immune, having survived COVID itself, or been immunized, and we will see our epidemic start disappearing. And so the only willingness to spend is very short term, get us to that magic moment. Now, the interesting thing is, when you talk to people on Wall Street who are, you know, in the top Fortune 500 investment firms, banks, and, you know, major entities on Wall Street, they're saying, hey, we want another all-out stimulus package. This is what's kept the economy going. If you don't infuse tons and tons of money, trillions of dollars into the economy, we won't ever bounce out of this, right? We're going to bounce out, but with worsened inequity, with worsened divide in wealth. And in the end, smart companies realize if we keep having all the bounce outs only go to reward the top elite of society so that the 1% keeps getting richer and richer, then you lose the spending power, the consumer power of the middle class. And then who the hell do you sell your products to?
I think this is a really shrewd political analysis, which is that, you know, all that the Republicans want to do is just potentially get to a temporary bridge. The Democrats want structural reform, and, you know, Congress, of course, is a bit in the balance. And I think you're 100% correct.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts, behind-the-scenes segments, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through all of our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X-Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to finish on two different questions, 2 points that are, because I think you're such a great thinker about these things, and I love talking to you about them. One is the question of entering and exiting the pandemic, the same country versus an improved country. And it's sort of that old Churchill quote about, you know, Americans will do the right thing after they've exhausted all the rest of the possibilities. One would think that we've exposed over the last year so many of the things that have been barely beneath the surface or have been above the surface but rarely talked about around racial injustice and inequity, around how capitalism's excesses foster real pain on people and don't solve the problems the way that systems do without some sort of government intervention, and that there actually is a cost and a price for liberty. You want your freedom, there is something, if you're going to be part of a society, that you have to contribute. All of those things, which are ripe for dialogue, and they're not easy topics, and they're not meant to be changed overnight. But do you feel a sense of optimism or pessimism that those, at least those conversations, can begin to take hold? Forget about whether or not we'll get instant legislation. There's no hope of that. But whether or not those conversations could take hold and eventually change the country for the better.
Oh, boy, that's a huge question. And it requires a lot of crystal balling that may be way beyond my skill set. I was in a discussion with Mark Carney, who is the former head of the Bank of England, and before that, the head of the Bank of Canada, and now is a financial investment honcho. And he was saying that the majority of the Fortune 500 corporations and pretty much the entire multinational business sector sees recovery as a must, that it is sustainable recovery. So in other words, his point was, no, we don't all want to go back to 2019. We want to go forward to a COP26 climate change, you know, improvement in the planet. We want to go forward to less dependency on fossil fuels, to a reimagined nature of the city, a reimagined nature of mass transportation, a reimagined nature of what are these cultural magnets and how do they function in society. And if we are in fact going to rebuild out of all of this in a more sustainable way, then we could theoretically get to 2024 and look back and say, you know, that year 2020 was the worst year ever. We hated it. We're so glad it's behind us. But look at how it pushed us to re-envision what we were as societies, what we were as energy utilizers, and how we would function as companies, as cultural sectors, and so on. I mean, I guess the only source of real hope that I see going forward, trying to envision out a decade from now, is that we take advantage of this horrible nightmare we're in to think, not how do we end the nightmare, but what was always my dream? How do we go from here to my dream?
Yeah, that's great. I love that. Last question for you, Lori. It's related to what I think we're up against the next few months, and it's going to sound like a very negative question, but I'm trying to be a realist here, because there's been some really positive news, as you've talked about, with the vaccines. Are we in a ticking time bomb of which only the vaccines can solve? And by that, I mean, have we proven ourselves completely unable to solve our way out of this pandemic without the help of science and a vaccine? And of course, even the vaccine requires the level of participation in community that all the other solutions do as well. So it still means certain. If we don't care about one another, we won't all take the vaccines. But without the vaccines, are we destined to be a country where we just irresponsibly allow one another to die? I mean, in other words, A more acute way of saying that is people are going to Memorial Day barbecue no matter what. There's either going to be a vaccine or not, and we're going to either have deaths or we're not. And so we really are in a race. Is that the right way to look at it?
When I was a kid, you would go to your driver's ed class and it would be full of all these health messages. And it was in those classes that we would also learn about cigarette smoke and alcohol and drug use and all of that. It was all sort of squashed in for some reason with driver's education. I've never understood why they were all mixed, but that's a separate point. And I remember, I've never forgotten this one movie because it had such a strong impact that was shown to us. The movie depicted men doing various things that were stupid to do. And then it would be one thing after another of macho behavior. And as the individual is dying, the slogan is, he's too tough to care. We've all now seen the examples of these families where loved ones got together for a birthday, a wedding, a bar mitzvah, now more recently Thanksgiving, and they all were too tough to care. They felt like, hey, you know, it's more important for us to be together. And then 7 family members die of COVID. Just unbelievable levels of carnage and grieving. I can't even fathom what it must be like to be one of the survivors in some of these situations. I can't imagine living with the guilt of that. Where we're headed, I think, one of the messages that's going to happen is that this too tough to care approach is so wrong-headed. We have to figure out a way to undermine it so that it is, I mean, I realize Biden's trying to say the counter to too tough to care is it's patriotic to care. I would say it's just humane. It's just pick your value system. Or if you're a Christian, if you're a Jew, if you're Islamic, if you're no religion at all, but you believe in good citizenship, if you grew up a Boy Scout, a Girl Scout, I don't care, but find a value that makes you recognize that too tough to care and community don't go together. You know, too tough to care and family don't go together. Too tough to care and society, with a capital S, don't go together. And that's the task, is to get America to separate the notion of don't tread on me, freedom, you know, liberty and rights, from duty to community.
I think you said it incredibly well, as always. I love the fact that you are always pushing for us to be better, not just thinking, but you are actually trying to get us somewhere. And so, it's so great. Lori, thank you for being on.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Fascinating conversation. Those could go on for a long time because she's got a lot to say and she's incredibly thoughtful in just getting her wisdom. Let me tell you about the next few episodes. On Monday, we have our Bubble in the Bubble, Make a Bubble, Be a Bubble podcast. It is a podcast with 2 terrific experts on how to create a bubble for yourself, your family, your friends, how not to create a bubble, more importantly, how to break into a bubble, all kinds of bubble things. And then Wednesday, Heidi Larson from the Vaccine Confidence Project. I said that in a very unconfident way. See, it's my dad joke. Vaccine Confidence Project. Because I'm confident in vaccines. That'll be great. We just had an episode on Monday on how to get your vaccine, when to get it, where you'll get it. Go listen to that if you haven't listened to it. I'd say listen to that podcast. Listen to the Winter Toolkit podcast if you haven't heard it. Those are the most, I think those are just really relevant, basic stuff. Go listen to some fun stuff in the archives too, because we make it free. Go listen to Tina Fey. Go listen to Kumail Nanjiani, My Enemy. Go listen to any of those people. And then a toolkit on getting back to work, how to go to work, the horror stories of work. I prefer not to work, but you have to work sometimes. And we'll talk about how to stay safe in your job. Thanks so much. Have a great rest of the week. Be safe. Thanks for listening to In the Bubble. Hope you rate us highly. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McGowan produce the show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuriev. My son, Zach Slavitt, is emeritus co-host and on-site producer, improved by the much better Lana Slavitt, my wife. Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax still rule our lives and executive produce the show. And our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, and additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media. And you can find me at aslavitt on Twitter or at andyslavitt on Instagram. If you like what you heard today, most importantly, please tell your friends to come listen, but still tell them at a distance or with a mask. And please stay safe, share some joy, and we will get through this together. Hashtag stay home.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us on Archetypes, a dynamic podcast hosted by Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, as she digs into the labels that try to hold women back. In each intimate and candid conversation, Meghan is joined by guests like Serena Williams, Mariah Carey, Paris Hilton, Issa Rae, and Trevor Noah as they delve into the roots of countless common descriptors of women, like diva, crazy, dumb blonde, and the B word, and redefine and reclaim each identity along the way. The complete season of Archetypes is out now wherever you get your podcasts.